This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, discussions about the debt ceiling are still dominating the headlines out of Washington, but there are some more interesting discussions going on about how we can reduce the cost of healthcare
and improve health. One of those is a recently released study which looked at the state of Oregon, where they actually had the opportunity to do almost a randomized control policy intervention study, if you will, and found that having Medicaid drove down healthcare costs by about 25% for new enrollees who previously had had no health insurance at all.
You know, it was really quite fascinating. Oregon found itself in this unique situation as the focus of a study on the benefits of Medicaid. In 2008, they only had enough money to care for about 10,000 residents. Unfortunately, 90,000 people qualified for Medicaid. So they used a lottery to decide who got the coverage. A Harvard economist and an MIT economist took advantage of this opportunity to compare those who won the Medicaid lottery to those who didn't.
And the outcomes were pretty fascinating. They found that the group that got the coverage really fared much better, and not just in health terms, but also financially. They were far more likely to actually go and get preventive care and regular care for illness from a provider. They also found the covered group reported that they felt much better physically and mentally. And as for the financial benefits, they were less likely to have had to pay out of pocket or to be in the predicament of deciding what other bills to forego in order for themselves to get medical care.
Margaret, it seems to make common sense, a study like this. But nonetheless, we encourage lawmakers to take a look at the study as it will save money and improve health in the long run.
And Mark, there was also another recent study that's worth noting, and that's one published in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine. And this one found that patients who received what we now call patient-centered care in a patient-centered medical home also reduced healthcare costs. And why is this? Well, the number of specialty care visits, hospitalizations, and diagnostic services used were significantly reduced for these patients in these practices. And I think we've talked about the patient-centered medical home before, with a very strict set of standards around technology and access after hours, evidence-based care, but most of all, an ongoing personal relationship with your primary care provider.
Electronic health records are also a critical tool in helping patients take a more active role in their health. Our guest today brings a great level of expertise on this subject. We're so glad that Dr. Farzad Mustashari, the new National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, can join us today to talk about a more patient-centered focus in health information technology, as well as the progress that's been made in the more widespread adoption of HIT.
And we are happy to welcome Dr. Mustashari on the program today. But no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chtradio.com. Subscribe to iTunes to get the show regularly downloaded, or if you want to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chtradio.com. And if you're a social media aficionado, become a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
As always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Dr. Mustashari, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. President Obama praised a new bipartisan plan emerging in the Senate, calling it broadly consistent with the White House's approach to raising the debt limit. The plan is being drafted by a bipartisan group of senators known as the Gang of Six. It would spend health care dollars more efficiently in order to strengthen Medicare and Medicaid while maintaining the basic structure of the critical programs. It would fully pay for the Medicare doc fix over 10 years, and it would also repeal the CLASS Act, a controversial long-term insurance program in the health reform law. Although school's out for the summer, Obama administration officials announced a boost to an important school-based program. The Department of Health has granted $95 million to 278 school-based health centers. It's the first installment of a $200 million appropriation under Obama's health care overhaul law. The second round of funds are expected to be distributed next summer. The money will help expand existing clinics and schools so that thousands more children and teens can receive essential health care services. School-based health centers are clinics that provide primary care to students as well as mental health and dental care.
Margaret and I are speaking today with Dr. Farzad Mostashari, the new National Coordinator for Health Information Technology within the Office of the National Coordinator at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome, Dr. Mostashari. First of all, congratulations on your new appointment. You bring a wealth of knowledge and experience to this role as a person in charge with implementing health information technology in a large scale. You became the national coordinator this past April, but before joining ONC in 2009, you served in the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene as an assistant commissioner for a primary care information project, and actually kept an eye on your role there and the project that you rolled out. It was very impressive. You helped more than 1,500 clinicians acquire and implement electronic health records to improve healthcare for the underserved population. Could you connect the dots for us on what you learned from that project and what lessons you're taking from it as you steer ONC forward?
Absolutely. It was an amazing experience, but what I think was most important is that it was a project that came out of the New York City Health Department. And the purpose of the project was to improve healthcare and to improve health, particularly for underserved populations, through the appropriate use, and what we would today call the meaningful use of health information technology. So the technology was a means to an end, and that end was better health for individuals throughout the city, but particularly in those in underserved communities. And that's the same perspective that I've brought to ONC, and I think really is a natural fit for us. It's really part of how we view this challenge. It's not a challenge about information technology implementation. It's really our goal and our mission is to improve health.
Dr. Mostashari, back in 2009, which now seems like a long time ago, we had your predecessor, Dr. David Blumenthal, on our show. And at the time, he outlined the obstacles that he saw that faced us in the widespread adoption of health information technology. And certainly he mentioned cost and logistics as key concern, also a shortage of health information technology workers and professionals to support practices. And in these past 2 years, we've seen very targeted efforts to address these obstacles. Certainly, the federal funding for regional extension centers to support practices and train practices, for the community colleges to train a new cadre of health information technology workers, and also that solid plan for reimbursing providers for investing in the EHR under the Meaningful Use Program. So as you came in and assessed the scene, what's your sense of the progress that's been made in just these past 2 years around the country?
It's been an really unprecedented acceleration. We had 20% of primary care providers in this country having basic electronic health records in 2009 when you spoke with David. And within a year, from 2009 to 2010, that went from 20% to 30%. And a large part of that, I believe, was the understanding that the health IT incentive payments have now created at least partial compensation for the cost of implementing such systems. As well, as you mentioned, we have established regional extension centers in every part of the country that are now signed up and working with 80,000 primary care providers. Wow. Throughout the country. Half of them in small practices or consortia of small practices, those who historically have had the lowest rates of EHR adoption because it's hard. It's hard work, as you alluded to. Making this change is hard. It's rewarding. It's the right thing to do, but it is hard to do it. And many providers, particularly those in small practices, don't have the capability around the project managing an IT project. And that's what the extension centers are really helping them with.
You know, speaking of things that are hard but also rewarding, I want to focus for a moment on your goal to implement a patient-centric healthcare system. The belief is that health IT will be able to improve the effectiveness of physician-patient relationships. You want to focus more on patient-centric systems, which goes one step further to engage the patient in managing their own healthcare. How does health IT help contribute in helping patients engage in their own health?
Oh, great question. That is one of my priorities for the next 2 years. There are three parts, I believe, to patient-centric, putting the patient in the center. The first is putting the patient in the center of the healthcare system. So really being able to view things from the perspective of the patient, what works for the patient in the healthcare workflows. And a lot of the workflows are now built around what's convenient and good for the doctors and nurses and staff, but not around what works for patients. So let's give some examples of this from meaningful use, right? So the meaningful use requirements that would trigger the health IT incentive payments. It says you should give people an after-visit summary. Because from the perspective of the patient, the minute you walk out that door, you've already forgotten half, up to 80% of what you heard in the visit. And particularly when it's you know, important news or where there's some emotionally heavy information, diagnosis, prognosis, treatment that was given. So as simple as that, giving the patient an after-visit summary, giving the patient education material, that's part of meaningful use. Giving patients access to their own information and a copy of their own information, that's part of meaningful use. So that's all part of patient-centered care. Another part is protecting privacy and security. So when we talk about putting the patient in the center, putting the patient and their interests in the center, the part of really important part of that is maintaining the public's trust in the privacy and security of their health information. And the third aspect of putting the patient in the center is literally giving patients the tools to manage their own care.
Well, Dr. Mostashari, I think for our listeners, what you are saying is really music to their ears. This is what people, whether they've been able to express it fully to us or not, that is, of course, what people have always wanted and what we've always wanted to provide to them. And my sense is outside the world of healthcare, the general public is a bit oblivious to this whole meaningful use process that's going on and the degree to which really you're fighting for patient rights and for patient progress in this. So I might ask you to elaborate on this a little bit more. First, just on some of the nuts and bolts in the weeds we've been reading in the papers about phase one and phase two, maybe phase two being pushed off a little more. What does that translate into? What should the public understand about the different milestones that you're asking practices to achieve in order to secure those investments under the Meaningful Use Act?
That's a great question. What does it mean for the public? And I think we really have to do a better job, not only in programs like this, but in a broader way of helping the public understand, you know, helping them put themselves in the middle of this health IT revolution that's happening and that's really a part of a transformation of the healthcare system. So what does it mean for patients? Well, one thing is there'll be things that'll start to happen to you that have great, wonderful things that have never happened before. So we have all gotten reminders from our dentist or our veterinarian or our mechanic, hey, your car is due for an oil change. But unless our doctors have electronic health records, we probably have never gotten a reminder for ourselves, for our health. You know, hey, congratulations, mm-hmm. You should get a flu shot. You know, you haven't come in to get your flu shot or, you know, life-saving things like colon cancer screening mm-hmm. Or your last blood pressure was too high, you haven't been back, or you didn't fill your prescription, I'm concerned. So starting to get reminders from our physicians, our primary care providers, is something that, you know, people will start to get, and it'll be almost strange at first. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll see that more and more.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Farzad Mostashari, the new National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. Dr. Mostashari has been telling us today that quality is fundamental to health information technology. In fact, it is the driver behind electronic health records. But can you tell us a little more about what's happening in the primary care space and who are the leaders who are using HIT to drive quality improvement?
Every day, I have a thick stack of certificates in front of me that I sign congratulating different providers across the country for being part of the movement, we call it, the Meaningful Use Vanguard Movement. And it's folks like Dr. Stephanie Brule in Kansas, small practice, primary care provider, family practitioner, not, you know, she's just a regular doc who said, you know what, I'm a primary care doctor, I'm going to take the plunge. And she focused on one thing in looking at what this meant for her. She looked at her cancer screening rates for colon cancer. She thought she was doing great.
Right.
But once she got the system, she realized she was only screening 40% of her patients.
Right.
And everyone thinks, you know, everyone wants to be at 100%. And what I loved was she said, I'm still not there yet. I'm only at 83% now. She went from 40% to 83% after implementing the health record. But you know what? I found three cancers early, and they were removed. And the patient is fine now, doesn't need any additional treatment. So those are the kinds of stories that we celebrate, and it's becoming more and more part of not the academic centers only, not the benchmark institutions or early adopters. It's becoming part of the mainstream of primary care, slowly but surely.
And those are really some of the experiences that put that joy and vitality back in primary care, certainly why people went into it. And Dr. Mastashari, let me pull the thread a little bit on the work of your office. Again, I don't think the American public has a good sense of just how vigorously your office, the Office of the National Coordinator, fights for patient rights to privacy and confidentiality and also accuracy. I've been reading about your Tiger Team, which is a great description for a group of people who are protecting other people's rights. And I was particularly struck by the emphasis on protecting a patient right to accuracy. Certainly, we've all had the experience, unintentional. There can be erroneous information that's put into a chart. Now, with this vision of patients having access and reading their own charts, patients may find an inaccuracy. You're looking for ways to make sure that there's a way to correct it, to correct any information that's been sent out to others. And if a clinician disagrees and thinks, no, that is accurate, that at least there's a way to record that the patient doesn't agree with that. Tell us about this Tiger Team. Who's on it? How are consumers represented? And what's their focus? And congratulations on forming one.
Thank you. This is part of our Federal Advisory Committee, and this is a group of outside experts who we bring in to advise us in a very structured and open and public way. So there are public hearings. We've had a public hearing in all through our Federal Advisory Committees every other day for the past 2 years.
Wow.
Every other day. It's hard to keep track of, but These are really the national experts, representatives, who are working in the public interest for free, for nothing, to give us the best possible recommendations. And one of the teams that we formed, as you mentioned, was this Tiger Team on privacy and security. And it really is really tackling the tough issues. The stimulus bill, actually, HITECH, which was passed as part of the stimulus bill in March of 2009, had some really important additional protections for patient privacy. It established the requirement around a reporting of breaches. If there is over 500 patient records that have been, for whatever reason, lost, misplaced, breached, they have to alert the media. They have to alert the patients. They have to alert the Department of Health and Human Services. And even if there's fewer than 500, they have to do it, to report to the department. So more and more, we are learning about and hearing about breaches, not because there are more breaches, but because we're learning about them, and we're requiring people. And this is making a difference in terms of healthcare institutions saying, "Gee, you know what? I really don't want to be on that wall of shame on the HHS website. I really don't want to have these now million-dollar fines that are being levied against more and more against healthcare institutions that didn't do what they should do to protect patient privacy and security, and it's having an impact. We are seeing a redoubling of attention on the part of healthcare providers to do what their patients expect from them, which is to keep their information private and secure no matter how it's held, whether it's in paper or electronic format. One of the rights that was also elaborated on in the HITECH bill, the legislation, was patients' right to their own information in an electronic format. And the really game changer there, one of the game changers there, is that when you share information with patients, they find inaccuracies.
Mm-hmm.
That's really powerful.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we had a great community health center in the New York area, Institute for Family Health, and they instituted this. And they said that their records, the quality of the data, improved dramatically. That initially the providers were a little hesitant.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, well, what's going to happen if we give patients their own information? And what they found was the patients they didn't abuse the, you know, they didn't come flooding in with kind of nitpicky stuff, but very important mm-hmm. stuff. You know what? I don't have an allergy to that
uh-huh.
medication.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Or I'm not taking that medication,
mm-hmm.
actually. Or I have this diagnosis.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. So, and part of that is, and we just had a discussion yesterday in our public hearing around making sure that the electronic health record systems have the capability to flag these corrections and to give the patients an opportunity to append their corrections or modifications or comments on these issues that they identify.
Dr. Mostashari, you mentioned a few minutes ago the Vanguard movement, and as you mentioned, I started to think about Todd Park, who's been on with us before, and you both represent a new generation of leaders within our government who are really engaged in social media. And I noted that you've been involved in investigating outbreaks of West Nile virus and cases of anthrax in New York City and helped to develop a real-time electronic disease surveillance system nationwide. Can you tell us how social media might help contribute to electronic disease surveillance and protecting public health?
It's a really interesting issue. And there's been a lot of, I think, two ways, a lot of possibilities in terms of social media, both looking at the broad patterns, right? Not that one person says, "Hey, you know, I'm staying home today because I have the sniffles," right? Tweeting that to their followers or posting it on their Facebook page, but looking at those patterns in aggregate, learning from the big trends and things like Google Trends. In terms of search terms that people put in. And there's been some really interesting experience learning from what's happening in social media. But I also think that what's really powerful is not only kind of sensing what's happening in the world by having our finger on the pulse of what people are publicly posting, but also of being able to effect healthier behavior through the use of social media.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Farzad Mostashari, National Coordinator for Health Information Technology at the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Mostashari, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's been my great pleasure.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on a partnership that's addressing the legal problems that can sometimes pose a threat to a person's health. Oftentimes, poor health results from socioeconomic factors in a person's life, things like inadequate housing, lack of food, and lack of access to health care. Although governments have enacted laws over the years to address many of these social factors that influence health, the benefits and the protections are not always afforded. So the idea of a medical-legal partnership was conceived in 1993 by Dr. Barry Zuckerman, chair of Boston Medical Center's pediatrics department. He was frustrated that non-medical issues interfered with his young patients' problems, and he brought in a lawyer to help. Out of that, the National Center for Medical-Legal Partnership was launched in 2005. Today, more than 200 medical-legal partnerships exist in hospitals and health centers across the country. These centers help patients with a number of issues, filling out applications for disability or challenging the findings of a disability hearing, pursuing landlords for failing to clean up apartments where roach droppings or mold trigger children's asthma attacks. Advocates for these partnerships know that sometimes healthcare providers can't address the fundamental problems that are making their patients sick or keeping them from being well. They hope that one day their efforts will make it much simpler for patients to address these legal needs without needing to see a lawyer. They're taking practical steps, putting in the form letters, standardized screenings, and legal information right into electronic health records as standard forms for providers and patients to use.
a partnership that works to make sure the system is properly addressing all the factors necessary for good health? Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.